we should be passionate about the eternal and about the things that do not pass away. There's things that we can do that will outlast us after we pass. So just this filter again on the world. Number one, the lust of the flesh. Just simply impurity, sensuality. Number two, the lust of the eyes. Coveting things that we want begins with our eyes. And especially, it's probably especially for us men with toys that we want, maybe things that we would like to have that are not ours, covetousness. And I'm sure you ladies have things as well. We have the pride of life, taking pride in our accomplishments, taking pride in our possessions, pride in our appearance, simply stems from a very selfish, self-centered worldview. That is the pride of life. So I'd like to talk a little bit about what to do about it this morning. And we would probably all agree that the world is pounding our doors down in this church and in churches in America at large, trying to convince us to conform to their system. Desperately breathing down the necks of our children, trying even to get our children to conform. Desperate for our children to become as the Babylonians. The example of Daniel there. So we first have to, number one basic thing we have to establish is the fact that it's an issue. The fact that the world wants us to conform to them and to acknowledge that it's a threat. And to acknowledge that the world is a threat. The world as in not so much the people, but the devil and his system. It's what the devil is trying to do. So if you believe the devil is desperate to push his agenda on you and your children, I hope today you can receive some encouragement going forward. And if we're going to pass on the faith to our children and to our children's children, and for many years to come, we're going to have to take some decisive action. I want to look at an example of a great leader in the Old Testament. Someone who had vision, and yet, there's a bit of a sad ending. So, Joshua, in Joshua 4, you remember when Joshua set up those 12 stones? And he said, the reason we're doing this is that way when our children ask, what in the world are these 12 stones doing here? Then we can tell our children, the reason for this is because of what God delivered us from back in the day. And it was a reminder to their children and children's children. So, Joshua had vision. I also believe that Joshua was a great leader. I do not fault Joshua here. And so there's different lessons we can learn. Turn to Judges chapter 2. Judges 2, we're going to begin reading in verse 6. When Joshua dismissed the people of Israel went each to his inheritance to take possession of the land. And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great work that the Lord had done for Israel. And Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110 years old. And they buried him within the boundaries of his inheritance in Timnath-Heres, in the hill country of Ephraim, north of the mountain of Gash. All right, here it is, verse 10. And all that generation also were gathered to their fathers. And there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord or the work that he had done for Israel. Now, why not? How is this possible that after a leader like Joshua, after establishing or setting up that memorial with those stones and the work that he had done there, how is it possible that another generation rose up who did not know the Lord or the work that he had done. And then you go on to verse 11, and the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. And they abandoned the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. They went after other gods from among the gods of the peoples who were around them and bowed down to them, and they provoked the Lord to anger. They abandoned the Lord and served the Baals and the Ashtaroth. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he gave them over to plunderers who plundered them, and he sold them into the hand of their surrounding enemies, so that they could no longer withstand their enemies. Whenever they marched out, the hand of the Lord was against them for harm, as the Lord had warned, and as the Lord had sworn to them, and they were in terrible distress. Now, how is this possible? After so many miracles, miracle after miracle after miracle, a generation who knew not the Lord, neither the things that he had done. And unfortunately, this is not a very unusual cycle for humanity. I have a book, I refer to this in my Sunday school, by Arnold Cook. And the title was Historic Drift, Must My Church Die? And I would recommend that to any of you. It's a deep dive into cycles and patterns of organizations and especially churches, and just looking at history and how some of these happen. And so I want to give credit to that. I do have some things out of that book here today as well. But even in our Anabaptist history, there's been times of growing cold and then times of revival. And I had to think back to my grandpa, who came out of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, a very dark Amish setting back in those days. I don't know a lot about that. I do know that he does not like talking about it. He doesn't like talking about the things they were involved in. They came out of a very dark period. And so I'm a third generation. So there was revival. What about my children? What about my children's children? Can we continue to pass that on? Or are we going to get caught up in the same third generation where it dies out? I believe it's very important for us to think long-term about passing on our faith to our children and their children and their children, and we make conscious decisions about that. If we're just going to bounce along life and we have no plan, we're not intentional, we don't really have goals, we're probably going to end up somewhere where we never thought possible. I'd like to look at the Pharisees a little bit. I don't know if you realize, but the Pharisees actually started out as a good organization, a good group of people. There was tremendous pressure for the Jews to accept the Greek pagan cultural practices of their time. And the rise of the Pharisees was a reaction and protest against this tendency among their fellow countrymen. Their aim was to preserve their national integrity and strict conformity to Mosaic law. Now remember, this is before Jesus. This is a good thing. These people were nonconformists. They refused to conform to the Greek culture. But what happened? I'd like for you to turn to Matthew 23. And here we again, we just have a couple hundred years. What happened? Matthew 23, I'm not going to read the chapter, but I encourage you to read along as we go verse by verse. And honestly, I'm not comparing us to the Pharisees, but our tendency would probably be a little bit more this type of thing, because we have a structure and we have a form. And it becomes very ugly when you have a structure and form with no life. And that's simply what was happening here with the Pharisees. The structure, the form can be good and is good, but when there's no life, it becomes a very ugly thing. And we'll see what Jesus talks about that here. I want you to think about what it would have been like to sit there as a Pharisee. So you're sitting there listening to Jesus, and you're proudly holding this Pharisee title. And here comes this man. You know, Jesus was grace and truth. Got a lot of truth coming out here. So in verse 3, he says that they don't practice what they preach. Verse 4, They ask other people to do things that they're not willing to do themselves. Verse 5, they do good so that others can see them. Verse 6 and 7, they love positions of importance and love to be recognized. Verse 13, hypocrites. Verse 15, hypocrites. Verse 16, blind guides. Verse 17, blind fools. Verse 19, you blind men. Verse 23, hypocrites. Verse 24, blind guides. Verse 25, hypocrites. You think you'd start getting the drift after a while. Verse 26, you blind Pharisee. Verse 27, you are whitewashed tombs, appear beautiful, but inside you are full of dead people's bones and all uncleanness. Verse 28 again, full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. Verse 29, hypocrites, and he saves the best for last, you snakes. Can you imagine being referred to that by Jesus? You brood of vipers, how are you to escape hell? The wrath of Jesus was saved for those who tried to portray like everything was beautiful on the outside and they were dead on the inside. They looked fine. They tried to look fine. They tried to act righteous. They also had nothing to offer. They became selfish and consumed with their own interests. And I'm just amazed at the lack of compassion of the Pharisees. Claiming to serve God and yet having no compassion for other people. How do we get there? They got caught up in the pride of life. Worldly hearts, but appeared as though they were godly on the outside. Even Jesus would say that, would have said that to them. Is it possible to be a member of a church like this and to sit here Sunday after Sunday with a worldly heart and be full of dead people's bones? To be lifeless. To have the form, but to have no life. That is a very scary place to be. Few things are more exhausting than having a worldly heart and trying to portray like you don't. That is very exhausting to pretend. Another example is the Galatians. If you look at Galatians 1, 6, and 7, this is Paul speaking. And I understand this is about 10 years. So Paul went through on his missionary journey. He established churches. And think of this being read a decade later, or written. I marvel that ye are so soon removed from him that called you into the grace of Christ unto another gospel, which is not another, but there be some that trouble you and would pervert the gospel of Christ. How so soon can a seed of deception come into the church like that? And even Paul was marveling at how fast this could happen. I would like for the children to come up. I'm going to tell them a story about something that happened to me about 2 weeks ago. So we're not going to take a lot of time. Just come on up here, and I'm going to tell you something that happened to me. There you go. Yeah. Okay. I want to ask you something. Do you all like snakes?
No.
You don't like snakes.
Black snakes.
Black snakes. Okay. So I was at work, and we had just got done delivering a pergola to a customer. And we were loading up, and Paul was with me, someone that works for us. And Paul went up to my truck, and he said, I don't think I'm going to get in there right now. He said, there's a snake in there. And this was in the work truck we had just driven in. And so he opened the back door, and here's this snake. And so he tried to get it out, and the snake went over towards my side of the truck. So that the back seat, there's a lot of tools, and there's a lot of places it could hide. So this snake goes over and goes over to the passenger side and goes under my seat and disappears. And we could not find the snake. So we were on the job, and we wanted to leave. You know, you want to get home. You don't want to get home late. So here we were, all ready to go. But we know there's a snake in the truck. Would have you kept driving?
No.
What would have you done?
Well,
called a wrecker or what?
Tried.
We did. We looked everywhere. Couldn't find it. Poking under the seat. Yeah, but if you could find it, but we couldn't find it. Did somebody say walk? Kiana, you would walk? You'd walk home. Yeah, I was in Clarksville. I mean, that would have been a walk. I guess we could have. But we didn't know what to do. And so we looked for it and looked for it, and someone came and helped us. We were even like the back of the seat. We were putting the zippers up. We were looking up into the seat. And then I went over. I was like, well, I'll try one more place. So remember, it had been in the back seat. So I go up to the glove compartment, and I just decided I'm going to try that yet. So I open the glove compartment, and I jump back because there was a snake right there in the glove compartment all coiled up. So here it had gone from the passenger's back seat over to the driver's side and somehow got up in the dash. So Paul tried to fling the snake out the door. So we opened the door. We tried to get this snake out the door. Well, couldn't. So of course the snake goes up in the dash. So now we know where it is. It's in the dash. So then I looked up. You know where the pedals are? So I looked up, put my head down there, I looked straight up, and I saw it up there, up behind the steering wheel, just curling itself around up there. I saw its tail move, then I saw the snake. Yeah. And then it completely disappeared. We couldn't find it. I was beating on the dash, hoping that it would come out. Even pulled a piece of the dash up. Tried to look down in there, couldn't find it. So here we were in a subdivision in Clarksville, and we had a snake in the front dash, and I knew it had been up in the pedals. So, you know, I'm going down the road, and what would happen if that thing would kind of come up when I'm driving? But what do you do? So we got in the truck, and we left. We left with the snake in the dash, likely right in front of me. I couldn't see it, but kind of up in there. And we went driving, got some lunch, and then we kept driving. And I was on edge the whole time. I don't like snakes. I can handle spiders, but I don't like snakes. And I was going down the road, and of course, yeah, I was going down the road. And then I kept looking down at my feet because what if it would, you know, you're going down the road, bite me, or like its head would come up and look at me while I'm going down the road and start crawling around on my leg while I'm driving. So I was kind of scared about that. So I was driving down the road, and one time I thought I felt something, and I jerked my foot, and it wasn't anything. I was just on edge the whole time. So we brought the truck home. Still never saw the snake. And we let the doors open that night. Let all the doors open. All next day, I put it in the concrete where there was concrete on this side, concrete on this side. And we don't want more snakes coming in. We want this thing to go out. And so the next night, we left the doors open as well. And as far as we know, the snake got out, but we don't know for sure. So we're driving the truck right now, having faith that it's not in there. Okay? So I'm going to be using this as an example for the rest of the message. Do you have a question? It was a black snake with kind of like a yellowish belly. So I knew it wasn't poisonous. If it would have been a copperhead, I probably wouldn't have got back in the truck. But I still don't like snakes. Okay? All right, you can go back to your seats. I would like to talk about snakes in our homes. I actually thought of this when this happened. I was like, you know what? Maybe the Lord's giving me this as an example to use. But there's snakes that want to come into our homes and want to rob us of our peace. There's snakes that come in that are definitely evil, that are definitely poisonous. And there's snakes that try to come in that are just simply not helpful. This black snake was not poisonous, but it was very unhelpful to have it with me that day. Don't let it be said of you that your children will grow up to not know the Lord or the work of the Lord. Would that not just be the saddest thing? That we need to determine in our homes that our children are going to grow up to know the Lord and the work the Lord that the Lord has done. So as you think of things in our home, don't just take away. We often think of taking away. Replace with something good. One of our children is a bookworm. I mean, just can't keep the books in the house. And there was one book that we had. Everything looked good. Christian book. Discovered there's things in there that I really did not want him to read. What do we do about that? Well, let's replace the book with a good book. Get your children involved in good reading. Take out the bad ones. This whole thing of books, I think, is a bit of a big deal. My wife and I, one time, we listened to the testimony of this lady. Had tremendous spiritual warfare that she dealt with. And it came through some of the things that she had read. And if you go to the bookstore, if you go to Books A Million, and you look at the trending books, it is pathetic. It is really, really bad. The gothic, the vampire, the everything in the dark world that you can pretty much bank on that to be trending. And so be very, very careful what books come into your house. Periodically, just go to your bookshelf and check to see what your children are reading. The devil would like nothing more than to just be that snake and to crawl up onto that bookshelf and to draw one of your children away. Get your children involved in prayer. Maybe you're in a crisis of sorts as a family. Maybe you have a financial difficulty. I don't know. Get on your knees as a family and ask God and watch him work. Let your children grow up to see the great works of the Lord. I think that's a very powerful thing when we get our children involved in prayer and we see mighty things being done. Be alert and understand that there is spiritual warfare going on. I'm realizing that more and more, that we are in a battle, and understand that the devil is out for your children. And of course, watch what your children do on electronic devices. Please, please, and you may hear about this at a later date, do not wait on the church to make the rules for your children's electronic digital input. I just love when I hear dad say, or someone say, I think it was in a business meeting recently we had this discussion, and when I hear someone say, my child's not going to have a phone till they're 18. There's a family phone they can use. My child's not going to have a phone until they're 18. I'm like, wow, someone's on it. Someone's being intentional. Watch who your children's friends are. If there's someone who's being a negative influence on your children, just don't let them go hang out there for the day. It's not of help. Your responsibility is for your children. Love other people. How in the world would loving other people help your children counter worldliness? You're showing your children what the alternative is. You're showing your children what purpose looks like, what fulfillment looks like. Our children need to see us serving others. There was a man here. It was actually Leon's brother. Anyway, so he was here for Bible school, and I just watched how he interacted with his family. It was just so beautiful, the way the children responded to the parents, how the parents related to the children. And I started asking questions like, how is this done? How is this possible? This is so beautiful. And what I learned was that he makes a very, very high priority with family time. He spends a lot of time at home with his family. And I know different things make that more possible than others. And also, and this is really where the lights came on, and it made perfect sense to me when I learned this. So there was a man, he was their neighbor, and he had said that he's going to shoot himself before he goes to a nursing home. And they said, no, don't do that. We'll take care of you. Please don't shoot yourself. We'll take care of you. Well, they went to Ukraine, and while they were in Ukraine, someone else from the church had been taking care of this man. They needed some help. So they actually came home a little earlier from Ukraine than they would have liked to take care of this neighbor man. And this neighbor man eventually came to know the Lord through all of this. And the children were all involved and saw all of this happen. And then everything started to make sense. You know, when our children see that mom and dad are intentional, have purpose in life, have found their purpose in life, have fulfillment in life, are secure in who they are, the children will simply follow. I believe that. Do ministry with your children. Shifting gears a little bit here. How do we keep worldliness out of the church? In Jude, it says, it talks about in the last days there's going to be scoffers following their own passions. Verse 19, it says, these be they who separate themselves, sensual and not having the Spirit. In other versions, it says, the people will cause divisions, are worldly, and do not have the Spirit. So interesting how a worldly heart is tied to two different things. A worldly heart divides and is not a welcome place for the Spirit. So a worldly heart comes in, the Spirit of God goes out, according to Jude. So going after earthly things, the temporal things, we actually lose the Spirit. In Hebrews 3, it says this, 12 through 14, take heed, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. But exhort one another daily, while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. For we are made partakers of Christ if we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast until the end. This exhort means to call near or invite. This is actually a very beautiful thing. So one another, draw and invite one another daily, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. Right there is a good remedy to avoid it. There's a few things we can learn. One simply is, it is possible to fall away from God. It's very possible. It's possible that something can gradually pull us away and eventually become as 13, where we have a hardened heart of unbelief. Ephesians talks more about speaking to yourselves in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord. Together, yourselves, ourselves, one another. That's how this is done. I could spend a lot of time there, but I'm not. The last verse there in 21, submitting yourselves one to another in the fear of God. That's a bit of an ouch sometimes. Why? Why would we submit ourselves to one another? Right there's a key. Right there's a way that we can avoid this. Okay. This book I was reading, I was referring to that. I want to read something out of this, and I want you to think about it. This is not an Anabaptist writing this. The strong religious organization makes very high demands upon its members. They must give it absolute and unswerving allegiance. Be willing to work, suffer, and die for it. Abandon all competing activities, allegiances, and responsibilities in its favor. Tell its good news tirelessly and unselfconsciously to strangers. Wear the humiliation on their bodies, submit to its strictures, conformities, and disciplines. Go where they are sent and do what they are told. Now that last part, we probably would cringe a little bit. So we often think that requiring things of others, maybe it's working against us. It was interesting in the research that they did. Churches who required things of their members were actually the healthy organizations. A healthy movement within an organization only happens when those within the organization are excited about what they believe in. We wonder why our churches are not more effective in bringing people in. And I think often we think we're making it too hard for people. I have said this and will continue to say this. I think it's because we don't believe in what we do. I think that's the biggest hindrance in our effectiveness, is that we don't really believe in what we do. We don't really believe in the necessity of being a called out people. We don't really believe in the fact that we should be a separate people. We start making compromises. The congregational churches in New England made concessions called the halfway covenant. This made provision for partial membership, an effort to accommodate the lukewarmness in children and grandchildren of believers who could not meet the demands of conversion. Commenting on the impact of this compromise, Franklin H. Little, an authority on the origins of Protestantism, noted that they not only have the covenant for their children again and again until there was scarcely a sliver left, but also progressively relax the standards of membership for those coming in from outside who could make no relationship claim. Compromise on expectations contributes to slippage. Let's make it easy. So the next generation comes along. Oh, I know my son or daughter, there's some things there that aren't good. There's some fruit there that's not good. And so we start making compromise, and we start dumbing down, and we start watering down, and our bar becomes lower and lower with every generation. Overlooking bad fruit is not a good strategy for a church. And here, as we think about how do we keep some of these things out of our church? Well, the beachy churches are very heavily influenced by Amish. It's just how it is. There's good things about that. There's some negative things about that. And I could talk about the good things. One, I would say maybe a little bit negative, is our view on how some of this looks. We think it's only up to the church leaders to take care of some of this. So I want to read something else. The subtle shift from stringency to stricture indicates loss to slippage. Early and strong movements. Remember, we want a strong movement. We don't want something that's dead. Early and strong movements. Members admonish and encourage other members to adhere to the core values. All members feel they have a personal responsibility to preserve the discipline and purity of the organization. This is healthy stringency. However, later in the movement's history, these actions lose their spontaneity. Members tend not to monitor one another. It now becomes the responsibility of the leaders. This is stricture when it is imposed. And I thought it was interesting. He referenced the Amish. He said the old order Amish would be a strictured survival of Anabaptist stringency. I found that interesting. I think that's something we're weak in. I'm going to give you an example. I want you to think about this a little bit. And for you visitors here, please, I hope you understand. This is for our church. I'm just going to give you an example. We had a men's meeting, I would say, maybe 2 years ago, and we discussed bringing phones to church instead of a Bible, a paper Bible. And we discussed that. Some thought phones would be fine, but I would say the majority wanted to keep the value of bringing a Bible to church. And so we decided in that men's meeting that we would bring Bibles to church. So I'm just going to use that as an example. You come in the back door on a Sunday morning. You come in and you walk past a brother that has his cell phone and he's on his Bible. Okay, this really bothers you. What are you going to do about it? That's a question that I want to leave. What would you do about it? Not my problem. I'm not a church leader here. I'm not ordained. I don't have the authority. Not my problem. If that is our mindset, that is not a good sign. And I think I can speak for the rest of our ministry team is that we are trying to move away from that mentality. And we are trying to move towards more accountability with one another. More a one another mentality where we all embrace the values. And I know we as leadership have a responsibility in this. We absolutely do. And maybe part of it is we're not very clear on our values. But I think it's so beautiful if we're clear in what we believe and what we want as a church, our value system here. And then we buy into it. Because if you buy in, then you have ownership. I know what it's like to buy into a company, and I also know what it's like to work for a company. You feel more ownership when you are an owner. And I think often in the church, we don't buy in. We fail to buy in. We always have this moving car. We always have a way out. We all want to be Mr. Nice Guy. We all want to play nice. You know, if I'm going to raise my family here, if I know my future is here, is that not going to spur us to action? If we're so worried about our image, we're so worried about what people think of us, we're not going to be very effective at all. What are you willing to do for the sake of your children? Are you willing to be misunderstood? And people that get out there in the trenches, make a difference, stand up for what's right, they are going to be misunderstood. And they are going to, at times, maybe have accusations leveled against them that are just simply not true because they are doing something. We've got to let go of our image. I heard something recently that something to the effect of what God can do with a man who lays down his reputation. I think that's where we should all be as church leaders, as dads, as fathers, whatever. We have to lay down our reputations and do the right thing for the sake of our children and the sake of our children's children. Will it be said of your children that they did not see or know the works of the Lord? How sad would that be? And if you want your children to know the Lord and your children's children to know the Lord, what will we do about that? There is hope. There is a way. It can work where generation after generation after generation fear God. And I know that's what we want here. And that's what we want to move towards. So God bless all of you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your attentiveness, and I do open myself. I know I said a lot today. Open my life for that as well. So let's kneel for prayer.